Hello and welcome to another episode of Alec Mappa Hot Mess with Matthew Dempsey, psychotherapist. I'm Alec Mappa. I'm an actor, comedian. I live in Hollywood. And welcome to the number one destination for drag queens seeking better mental health solutions.
Yes, welcome. And I'm Matthew Dempsey. I'm a multicultural counselor and psychotherapist.
Oh no, Matthew, I can't hear you.
Why?
Matthew, I can't. What happened?
Is it just me? I can hear myself.
Did Jamie mess with my audio? How come I can't hear Matthew?
I don't know. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. I can hear you now. Oh, good Lord. What did you say? Did you say I'm Matthew Dempsey, psychotherapist?
And multicultural counselor. That's right.
Okay. So today we're talking about fixing negative self-talk.
Yeah.
All right. So right before the show, I looked into, because we use Zoom for, you know,
recording.
Recording. We do Zoom for recording and we use part of the video for our social assets. And usually my skin is right on point, but I have a bright red zit on my nose.
Which you can't tell until Alec gets about 1 inch away from the camera. Right there.
And like, but that's now it's all I can think about. Look at it. I'm nearly 60 years old and I still have acne. It's wrong. It's sick and wrong.
Okay. Is that your negative self-talk?
No.
Have any blemish or imperfection at a certain age?
Yes. Yes. That is my negative self-talk.
How come? Why not?
Because I'm supposed to be perfect in every way. That's why, Matthew. Why else? Because we're gay men and we're supposed to be on top of it and we're supposed to be perfect.
Yes.
And if we are not, we are pieces of shit.
Why would you say that's very specific to us as gay men? How come?
Because we grow up overcompensating. Mm-hmm. You know, I did. My father was very homophobic growing up. His language was homophobic growing up. It was very clear that he didn't like that I was such a big sissy. He was always kind of like, and I said, like, was, like it's past tense. Like it's all gone.
You're healed.
And I'm completely mask for mask here. It's not that funny. Easy. So because my father was so, I loved him and I really wanted to please him. I was so hard on myself because he was hard on myself. And so as a result, the voices are tough on myself. Like as an example, and then I want to hear your take on this.
Yeah.
Your experiences with this. I was doing a pilot earlier this year with Alec Baldwin and Kelsey Grammer. And every time the producers would call me or they'd text me, can we talk to you for a second? And it was usually something great, like you're doing a great job or what are your ideas on this? But my first thought was I'm being fired.
Oh, yeah.
They hate me and they're getting rid of me. Like I immediately awfulized it.
Yeah.
And I had to like stop to the point where the producers were like, Alec, shut up. We love you. because I would always ask you like, what's wrong? And he's like, Alec, you're not getting fired. We think you're hysterical. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So, but that's how tough the voices are in my head in a pinch. Do you have any situations where you're like that with yourself?
Well, I do. But just to comment on what you're talking about, it's easy for us to catastrophize, right? Like you say, awfulize, catastrophize. We kind of jump to the worst case scenario because of this history of negative self-talk, this really deep-rooted core belief that something is inherently wrong with who we are, that there is an inadequacy kind of within us.
And it's also a juvenile perception, right? It's based on a child's perception, self-perception how we learned.
Yes. I mean, these are things that we learn really early on in life. And so for us, as we've talked about, we grew up having, our own internalized homophobia and thinking that there was something inherently wrong with who we are. So even when we get to a point then where we come out and we live our lives as openly gay, we can still have that deep-rooted core belief that there is something inherently deficient about us. And then that can manifest in so many different ways. And we can kind of get anxiety about it and have that negative self-talk spin, which is why it's important for us to know what that negative self-talk is.
Yes.
And be able to give it context so we can see the bigger picture. Like, For example, I'll be real vulnerable. Okay, so. Okay.
Welcome to the show. Thanks. I'm the one walking around vulnerable. With egg all over my face, and you just get to look.
I mean, you think I'm going to talk about major? You think I'm going to talk about major drama? But it's also like really kind of superficial blemishes and stuff. But
all right.
I because you know that I've been getting these like bad styes in my eyes, right? Like over the last couple of years, I've
they
had some
have
as
been
we've
disgusting.
Like how you've been able to look at me? I don't know. You're brave. And so this has become kind of like the newest place where I project a lot of my anxiety. Like anytime that I'm, it's so irrational and I'm so aware of it. It kind of drives me crazy that I can't like control it more, but like, it is what it is that I get so paranoid that I'm going to get styes. And it particularly shows up when I think like, if I'm in a really vulnerable space, like I kind of started talking to this new guy. We've been on like a few dates. He's nice. And we're going to go out tonight. And I'm feeling like out of nowhere, I'm like, I've got a sty. I'm going to get a sty. Oh my God, there's something wrong with me. It's going to be gross.
You start being anxious about the sty in advance.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so crazy because it's just, I focus, hyper focus on this one stupid fucking thing.
Who would do that? Who would do such a thing?
Alec is bringing his nose really close so he can show us his blemish again.
Who would focus on one tiny little thing?
But it's important because if I wasn't more aware of the larger picture of, okay, where is this coming from? Like, what is this really about?
Right,
and
right.
Where is this coming from? And what's the story that I'm telling myself? If I'm not plugged in consciously into what that is, then all I'm thinking is I'm crazy. I'm stupid. This isn't real. Like, blah, blah, blah. And then I just beat myself up over it.
And there's the majority of the people who don't know, I feel like there's all these people walking around there. By the way, this is a mental health podcast, everyone. And if you're tuning in for the very first time, welcome. And a download and subscribe. And if you're coming back, thank you. We're so grateful that you're here. We started this podcast in order to talk about things like this, in order to take the stigma out of it. So I think there are people walking around there, and I was one of them before therapy going, why am I obsessing on this zit night and day?
Yeah.
And what therapy did for me was it helped. I started holding myself accountable for my thoughts, because it's not enough to have the thought. You have to kind of recognize that you're having the thought.
Yeah, you have to be being aware, and this is a practice for us, being aware that we have thoughts. We are not automatically identifying with that. These thoughts are not us. So we have thoughts. These are stories that we've learned, and we continue to kind of perpetuate and, you know, kind of run through these narratives over and over and over again until we become conscious of it. Don't identify, give ourselves enough breathing room to just kind of observe the thinking. And then we have an opportunity to start rewriting those narratives. You know,
Are you dating? Are you dating somebody new?
I literally just said I've gone on a couple of dates with a guy. What more do you want me to tell you?
I would love to see you.
It's been just a couple dates.
I would love to like dress up as a waiter and just eavesdrop.
Can I tell you?
Cute on a date.
I give really good first date, and then it's the second date that I get a little bit nervous.
Like you're like, let me get to know you. Let me get to know what's wrong. Why are you pulling away?
Right, because then you start to get to know somebody a little bit more, and there's a little bit more access. It's a little bit more vulnerable.
I want to share with you a childhood memory, which kind of really paints the hard wiring that I'm overcoming in my brain.
Okay, tell me.
Because I do believe that the negative self-talk starts early.
Yes.
And my therapist said, the healthiest we'll ever be is not that you'd never have any stuff, because I'm like, I had one session where I was like, why are we still talking about this? I've been seeing you for 10 years and the same shit keeps coming up. He goes, the stuff will come up. The healthiest we can ever be is when we say, where is this coming from?
Yeah.
Or at least, at the very least, just recognize I'm in my stuff right now.
Yeah.
And I know that this is negative, and I can tell myself a different story.
Yes. I came across, my friend posted this yesterday. It was this really cute post on some account. And it was this kind of like carousel of like, it was like a comic, kind of like a little cartoon story.
Yes.
And the story was titled Befriend Your Shadow. And it was this really cute.
You put it on your Instagram story.
I put it on my stories. Go check it out. It's this really cute kind of story where, you know, where it's like the you know, you kind of always want to like push away, like, go away. You're making me crazy. Like, you know, you think you need to push away any uncomfortable feelings or negative self-talk. And that's not what we want to do. We want to make sure that we're not judgmental and pushing it away. We want to give it a little bit of space to come up so we can actually take a look at it, just become a little bit more curious about it. And then we can kind of like gently nudge and, you know, rewrite and things like that, but not in a way that we have to get rid of it altogether.
That way you're going, shut up, negative talk, go away.
Because it's not going to happen. The more you push back, the more it's going to push back on you. It's like trying to fight your way out of quicksand. You can't do it. It doesn't work.
In kindergarten, back in the Jurassic era, when I was in school, we had, it was really important to me, even at kindergarten, to be a good boy.
Yeah.
And that was a huge part of my coming out. When I was crying and I was telling my mom, I inadvertently inadvertently said, but I'm still a good boy. I'm a good boy. Meaning that I didn't necessarily think of myself as a good boy. And in retrospect, I was the sweetest boy ever. I was just so sweet. So we got to wrap it up because we have.
But I love that you said it out loud and even kind of asking for like license so that you can maintain a positive narrative and self-talk for yourself that you're a good boy.
I'm a sodomite, but I'm still a good boy. I take it up the booty hole, but I'm still a nice person. So, okay, weirdest segue ever, kindergarten. It's Milk Money Week. And then we're going to bring on our guest. We have an amazing guest today. We have Denali from RuPaul's Drag Race, who is even more beautiful in person than she was on the show. I mean, just a beautiful, beautiful performer. And we're going to talk to her, and I can't wait. So it's Milk. We had to bring in 35 cents. Dime and a quarter for milk money for the entire week. That's how much it cost in 1862.
Are you still talking about kindergarten?
Yes.
Well, okay.
Because I'm talking about this is what I'm working against.
Okay. Gotcha.
I forgot my milk money. I reached into my pocket. They said there's 35 cents and we haven't even been let in yet. And I remember this so vividly.
Yeah.
I was like, do you have your 35 cents today, Alec, for milk money? And I reached in my pocket. I didn't have it. And I reacted as if what somebody just said, your mother died.
Yeah.
I broke down. I was crying. I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
Oh no. Like I catastrophized it to the point like something horrible was going to happen because I forgot. And like, there was like a parent there who was like, shut the fuck up. Here's 35 cents. Like quickly handed me the thing and said, Alec, it's okay. It's okay. Yeah. It's okay. But to me, looking back on it, and I've discussed this in therapy, it was that was the chink in the armor. That was the imperfection.
Yes.
That it was like, oh, I did something bad. I'm bad.
And that's what it feels like. Anytime that if we have any kind of negative experience or any kind of issue or conflict, sometimes it really can feel like, oh my God, I'm fully masks off. I'm revealed. This is what's wrong with me.
And my world is coming to an end.
Right. And I'll never be loved. Yeah.
I'll never be loved. Nobody will love me. Coming up next, Denali from RuPaul's Drag Race. We're talking about negative self-talk and how to turn that around. We'll be back right after these messages.
Hey, all you true crime fans, this is Mike Ferguson.
And this is Mike Morph.
And we'd like to invite you to listen to our podcast, Criminology.
Launched in 2017, we've covered a variety of strange cases from murders to missing persons. Some of the cases are ones you may not have heard of.
Other cases we cover are some of the most historic in true crime. There are 200 episodes of Criminology available to binge on right now. And new episodes come out every Saturday night.
Subscribe to Criminology today, wherever you listen to your podcast.
We're very excited to get to know our guest today. She's a professional ice skater as well as a drag queen. You may have seen her as a recent competitor on RuPaul's Drag Race season 13, where she has been an undeniable fan favorite.
She's been an undeniable fan favorite. She's about to start touring in the UK, Canada, and beyond. So look out for that. Please welcome to the show, the fabulous Denali.
Yay!
Hey y'all.
Hi. Thank you guys so much. Thank you so much for doing the show and agreeing to talk about such tender, squishy subjects. Now I was crazy about you on your season.
Oh, thank you.
And we heard from our producers that while the season was going on, you didn't feel seen. And I felt like you were a major part of that season.
You know, it's so crazy because truly this topic that we're talking about today is so poignant in my life. And it's something that's followed me so much, but it was very prevalent during my airing on RuPaul's Drag Race because, yeah, I did feel kind of invisible. It was a really weird experience and it was completely not the case.
Yeah, you know that you were a man in a dress and makeup and stuff. You were kind of hard to miss.
That part I knew. I was a big old lady with big blonde hair.
So lay it out for us. What was like, what was the specific instance where you felt like I'm not being seen based on what we saw on the show? Like what episode?
Right. There is an episode where I think it's an acting challenge or something, but I'm wearing my favorite outfit and it is a chandelier gown.
Amazing.
It was made by my incredible friend, Joshua Naponte, hand stitched like every single bead.
It was incredible.
Thank you. It was for the beads category. And I was just really like, I just love that dress. It meant so much to me. And I explained to the, you know, producers why it meant so much to me. And like, I just really felt like, oh, this was a good episode for me. And not only did that explanation not air on the show, but that challenge, I was safe. And I think that that was like the third week in a row that I was safe. And granted, any girl that's safe in that show and in that environment should celebrate that because it is such a, it's such a crazy.
But you didn't go to be safe.
I didn't go to be safe. No. And I, you know, when I get in competition mode, I go to figure skater mode and I want to be the very best that I can be. And I want to be seen and I want to be rewarded for that. So I thought I did really well. But again,
you
I think
looked
that that's
like the
when...
chandelier at the Cosmopolitan in Las Vegas.
Oh my God. Yes.
It was that elaborate. It's like Matthew, it's like she walked into the chandelier at Las Vegas. And I think who won the beating competition that it was who won it was it Olivia
I want to say it was Olivia. You're right.
Olivia won and it was not as elaborate. It was a nice look, but in Denali's full disclosure, in Denali's defense, I felt like she was robbed in that episode.
You know, sometimes in the television world or in really just any sort of entertainment world that produces engagement from a fandom or from a fan base, sometimes having a person that the fans really, really support suddenly get robbed or whatnot, it only increases engagement. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes reality television will do that in order to increase engagement, even if you think it's unfair. If you think it's unfair, 10 times the amount of people are going to talk about that unfairness. And that just increases ratings and engagement and everything like that. So who knows? But at the end of the day, you know, who knows how it's really judged? At the end of the day, I felt really invisible. And unfortunately, because I'm someone that really cares about their craft and their art, I internalized a lot of that feeling. And I took that narrative that was on the show into my real life. And you know, it was really difficult. So, you know, not only did I feel invisible there, but then I started to, I went home and I internalized that. And I was like, you know, you are just that girl. You're just kind of that moderate girl. You're the safe girl. You're that not really noticed girl. And that's okay. Let's just try and do our best with what we've been given. It's still a wonderful platform. It's still a huge opportunity. So let's work hard after and produce some cool content or whatnot. But when I tell you, it was the most healing experience to have the real world and to have fans understand and be like, hey, girl, we see you. We see you. Oh. You're not invisible. You might be invisible to TV and Hollywood and producers and the judges or whatever, but we totally see you and we love you. And that was like, it just like, it blew my mind. And when anyone says like, what was the most defining part of your experience on Drag Race? I will always say the fans, because it made that whole experience just a whole full circle, tied in a bow, wonderful kind of thing to be seen. You know, everyone wants to be seen and everyone wants to be visible. So
everybody wants to be seen. And I think especially for us as queer people growing up where we've had to, like, you know, historically hide for so long, it's like, not only do we want to be seen, but we finally want to be told that we're enough and that we're okay. And, you know, we kind of feels like sometimes we need to really overshoot in order to get that validation.
Absolutely.
So it can be that much more painful, especially like you, Denali, when you're talking about putting yourself out there, you put all of your heart, all of your creativity, all of like this authentic expression, like out there. And then it was just tepid, right? At least that's how it felt for you. Right. Mm-hmm. And so of course it can really be triggering and, you know, kind of bring up all that negative self-talk that we're talking about. But what I'm hearing from you is that it was that you were really able to like kind of recognize that you were able to kind of like temper in some rational thought. You were able to kind of coddle yourself in a way that you kind of felt like you got yourself to a decent place. And then it was like icing on the cake when you got all of this, you know, kind of fan support.
Yeah. I'm hearing a lot of positive self-talk actually in the kind of like post experience of it.
But you said that I did kind of like go into your life, seeped into your life a little bit. So like, before you got to a really good place, what happened? How'd you spell?
Oh, yeah.
Spell.
it was a journey, you know? It was a journey. I got home and it was global pandemic time. Yes. Mm-hmm. So not only was all of this happening in my mind and in my soul and in my life during, you know, drag race and TV world, we got home and then I had to sit at home with my thoughts and I had to sit in quarantine and not have as a lot of my kind of support around me besides my boyfriend who I was quarantining with, who, my God, the most patient man, shout out to Big Head Alex for just taking in all of the stress.
His name is Big Head.
His name is Big Head.
Wow.
That's and that's not just the size of his cranium.
You had me at Big Head.
That's his online persona / nickname, and also what the fans call him. Shout out to him for taking on all that stress that was, you know, post drag queen quarantine drama.
Yeah. How did that manifest itself? What did you do? Well, how were you behaving?
So it started to seep into my personal life a lot. I really got insecure about us, about my relationship, and then also about the future of my career, because I was like, oh, you're just a moderate girl. You're an eighth place kind of girl. You are a safe girl. That's probably how you're going to be reflected in the real world. So you might get a few bookings. You might get a few little sponsorship things here. Like maybe you'll take some cute pictures with some people, but you're probably not going to have millions of views on YouTube, or you probably won't be booked every single weekend all across the world. You probably won't be loved by a lot of fans. Like, I just really started to internalize all of that. And I put a lot of that stress onto my partner. I put a lot of that stress onto myself, where I was just like, I'm not going to have a career. And I feel very indecisive about everything that I do, every single decision I make. And I just started to project a lot of that, uncertainty, I think, everywhere throughout my life. And I think it wasn't until the fans and the way things kind of like unraveled that I realized that I was going to have a perfectly fine career, not only a perfectly fine career, but one that was very successful. And I look back at that those few months that were in quarantine, and I just think about how tough I was on myself and how difficult that was. But I'm really proud of myself, because instead of letting it manifest and fester for too long, what I did was I put a lot of that negative energy into creating content, because we were in quarantine and I was like, you know what? I think the fans will really consume content well, because they're all sitting at home on their phones anyway.
Right. Yep.
You know? Yeah. So I made some really unique stuff. I did ice skating videos. I did some really cool photo shoots. I did some with live animals, and like just really tried to make my whole package, is what we call it, our drag race packages, very unique. And I think because of those reasons is why the fans connected to me so to see everything fall in place where but, it has. I'm just
like, also let me just say this too, because like, you know, we kind of go into this talking about like all the negative self-talk and whatever, but you already are like killing it with rewriting these narratives.
Yeah,
like you're like talking about all the different ways that you're proud of yourself and all the things that you've been able to do positively to kind of follow suit, which is amazing. And
that's
exactly
what you did.
And I also kind of like really relate to this idea that it feels like in order for us to be enough, you have to be extraordinary, right?
Yeah.
Like, because, and that's the bullshit narrative that we've learned from a very early age in life, because there's something inherently broken and damaged and deficient about who we are that we have to really overcompensate for that. So be extraordinary. Otherwise you're not going to fucking matter.
Be a star.
Or yes.
My narrative forever was be a star. Or you're nobody. And my narrative in my head over 20, you know, when I was in my 20s was you're not going to make it. You're not going to make it as an actor. And here, 35 years later, whenever I enter a dry period where it's like, you're not going to make it, I said, I've been here for 50 years. I'm still working. Shut
up. You've made it.
Denali, take us back. Because you had a very arduous childhood. You grew up in Alaska. You're the first RuPaul's drag queen from Alaska. What town were you in?
True. I grew up in a town called Fairbanks.
Fairbanks, Alaska.
Fairbanks, Alaska. It's the second largest city in Alaska, but that's not really saying much. Right. Like within city limits, it's probably about like 30 to 40,000, I think, which is quite a bit you'd think, but Alaska is half of the size of the United States. A lot of people don't know this. Yeah. Alaska is massive.
Yeah.
You see it on your little, we call you guys the lower 48 because we're, you know, up here and the rest of the US is the lower 48.
It has three different time zones in Alaska. That's how big it is. Yeah.
I mean, it has multiple time zones. Yes. But like, it's just massive. And what people don't know is that like, it does take up half the United States. So even though my city was about 40,000 or something, it's so spread out that it was still very, very, very small town. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Alaska, grew up in Fairbanks, where if you weren't figure skating, doing hockey or skiing, you were doing drugs and getting pregnant. That's just right. Like how it went.
And it was a conservative environment, your family, very religious, I understand.
Yes. I was raised very, very Christian, and I went to church very often. My mother is Mexican, so she really pushed a lot of those religious ideals on us and things like that. And I wanted to be a good little boy. I was the youngest, and I just wanted to impress my mother because I was a young gay boy who basically just wanted to be his mother. So I worked my ass off to pray the gay away and say my scriptures all the time, and and it just got to a point where my teenage years and that fervent desire for men just coincided, and like I couldn't handle it anymore. But it was really tough throughout those really intense and very formative teenage years. Mm-hmm. I think I had known that I was queer at 13, and I came to my mother and I addressed it to her as, hey mom, I think I have something wrong with me. Like I am disgusting. There is this like feeling I feel when I see an Abercrombie torso or I go to the underwear aisle at Target and I can't handle myself.
Right.
It feels like torture.
It feels like torture. And her immediate response was, okay, well, we're going to pray and we're going to fix this. You know, it wasn't my dad, surprisingly, they always butted heads, and my dad was not very religious. And he was like, oh, my brother is gay. Don't worry about it, Cord. You'll be fine.
Yeah. But you want your mom to love you. You want her to love you, and you want her, you want to be, you don't want your own mother, your own flesh and blood. You know, it's so funny. Like I have a teenager now who's 16. Oh, God, I'm so old. He's a junior in high school. And there's so many queer kids in school who do not have any of the baggage that we have.
I am so jealous. Because
the
Gen
parents
Z.
Are like, who cares? Like, even my own son, homophobia baffles him. He's like, hate somebody because they're a dick. Don't hate them because they're queer.
Right.
But, you know.
Oh.
So how old were you when you got away? I understand you were... You were an ice skater on Royal Caribbean, and I did a ton of gay cruises. And on one of the cruises, one of the ice skaters was fired because he went to one of the dance parties. And this is how shady Royal Caribbean is. They let him do all of his shows during the entire week. And after his final show, he said, you're fired.
What? Wait, he was fired because he went to like a gay dance party?
He went, you're not supposed to go down to the dance floor and fraternize. And this kid not only went down to the dance floor, fraternized, was part of the party. It was a gay cruise. And these kids are stuck at sea for months at a time. And they were like, gay people. And
he was like talking to the gays.
Yeah, he got fired. Was that you?
That was not me. I was never caught. I did the same thing. You are at sea and there's beautiful people. And sometimes you just want to have fun with the beautiful people. I left. So my life, I've lived like 20 different lives, but every 3 to 5 years, I completely change my life and I do something else. But at the time when I was coming out, I was 17 years old. So between 13, when I told my mom that I was gay, and 17, I really tried hard to pray the gay away. And those were the years that were extremely formative and very damaging for a long time. For 5 years, I hated myself. I was like, I was like, I'm an abomination. I'm going to all. And then, I was training competitively for figure skating at 17 years old. And it's when I met my first group of gay people, which were my fellow ice skaters. And then it wasn't until cruise ships that I really met like a lot of gay people. Cause like literally queer people run entertainment and run the cruise industry.
Right.
That's when I really blossomed into my queerness. And I think really started to embrace just all of it, my sexuality, the way I wanted to dress, the way I wanted to present myself, everything. So,
When we grow up feeling that level of shame, obviously the kind of the first major defense for us is to just hide it, right? To be closeted, to not open up about it, talk about it. But then after we come out, and then especially when we get to connect with other gay people or queer people and feel a sense of community, then it helps us open up more. But then we also kind of find these more subtle, kind of nuanced defenses for us, right? Like ways that we try to cover up that something's not enough. Like we try to outshine or overperform or whatever.
Yes.
I know for a little bit, kind of at the start of my career, I threw myself into work. Kind of I felt I needed to hustle, all that kind of hustle culture bullshit. Mm-hmm. And to try to kind of prove something, right? That was me trying to cover up something. What was that for you? Was that work also?
Absolutely. I think drag queens, first of all, are all workaholics. We're all egomaniacs and we are all our own stars. So I think that all of us believe that if we're not hustling enough, and I'm not going to lie, the drag race culture also has produced a bit of this, if you don't hustle hard enough for this first year after you are off the show, these next girls are going to come along and you are going
to be forgotten.
They're going to wipe you out. I've had multiple managers when I was deciding who I was. One of the last of my cast to link with a management team because I didn't trust anybody. But I had multiple managers tell me, one of them, and specifically word for word, said, "Listen, sweetheart, your 15 minutes of fame are going to be up here really fast. So if you don't link with me, the next girls are going to come right along. And that's just the way the business runs."
No.
Fear-based management.
Fear-based management. And I was like, wow, are you trying to sell yourself to me? Because that is not the ticket, sweetheart. I was like, anyways, not going with you. Thanks. But no, so I just want good, honest people that are around me that are willing to fight for me. That, it's as simple as that. That's why I praise Simone so much, because she's really maintained her house that literally came from Arkansas to where she is now. She's on Jimmy Kimmel and she is, modeling for a million campaigns in Moschino and just killing it, all while keeping her circle that was from the very beginning around her, because they were people that she trusted. And I really commend that. But this culture teaches us to hustle, 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 because the next girls are going to come around and it's going to be hard and you're going to be forgotten and all of this stuff. And I'm telling you, we are all exhausted. We are so, so tired.
It sounds like you set the bar really high for all of yourselves. Now, you talked with our producer, and it seems that at some point your negative self-talk, the talk that, and I really believe that it's kind of like the talk that we were that was bestowed upon us when we were young.
It was imprinted on us. We were conditioned this way.
It had consequences for you in the form of a drug habit and mm-hmm. you got in a little bit of trouble.
Oh yeah. Oh yes. There was a time. So after cruise ships, I was touring on cruise ships for a while.
How many years?
I was on cruise ships for 4.5 years, I believe. Yeah.
So you went everywhere. You went to the Mediterranean, the Caribbean.
Yeah, there's very few jobs after, you know, being a competitive figure skater besides like Disney on Ice. Mm-hmm. So I decided to do cruise ships and I liked it for my young 20s. But as I got into my mid 20s, I was like, okay, there's got to be more than this. It's a very isolating life. So I wanted to move out of it. And it's when I discovered drag. And I really wanted to try drag because it just felt, I wanted to produce art that was completely mine. Mm. I didn't want to have to be a certain role. I didn't want to be a boy too. I didn't want to have to be Aladdin. I wanted to be something that I created. So drag was really intriguing to me. But this one final opportunity came along and it was Cirque du Soleil, which was like, oh my God, so glamorous. It must have been so amazing. Cirque du Soleil, right? It was a show that featured ice skating for the very first time.
Oh.
So they employed ice skaters and it was so exciting. It was going to change the game. We were going to fly. We were going to do acrobatics. We were going to do everything. So we get there. There's Olympians in the cast. It is such an amazing and an honor, you know, to be a part of. And at this point I'm at like peak, like, oh my God, I'm so tired of tour life, but let me do this one last one because it's supposed to fix everything.
Right.
Mm. First of all, there were three queer people, three in a cast of, I think 80 people.
With all those ice skaters, there's only three. That's weird.
Only, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now we're out.
So, you know, at this point I am yearning for a sense of queer community even more. And I'm shoved into probably the most hetero environment I've ever been in. Mm. And it really affected me, but also the show was a circus show on the ice. So it was created by circus people who did not give a shit about us. They were like, we don't care about you all. Even though we're doing this on the ice, you guys are people that can push an object from point A to point B quickly. And you can do this and you can do that. And it was the most unfulfilling artistic experience of my life.
Oh no.
So it was devastating. And I was supposed to be on this contract for 2 years. So I was like, I'm gonna go crazy. And within a few months, I linked up with another guy who was a heavy Coke user. And I was like, hey sis, let's get through this contract together.
Oh like, yeah.
Not healthy at all. And within a few months, I started to develop a bit of a habit. And then you know, it was kind of the thing where every time we go out after the shows or whatever, I'm using. And then there was one night where we were in San Antonio, Texas. It was very early on in the tour. It was only like 3 months in or something like that. We were in San Antonio, Texas. I went out with my two other girlfriends, the two other gays that were on cast, and found a stripper. Was like, hey, dude, you have some coke? Okay, great. We are leaving the club, and it is a notorious club in San Antonio, a gay club that is patrolled by police for drug activity.
Oh, no.
And so the police rush up to us and I'm very calm. I'm like, hey, we're just trying to go home. Nothing's happening. But a friend of mine that was with me, who was like 7 years my senior, bolts. He just starts to run.
Oh no.
He just sprints away, which is immediately the cops go, work. Okay, we're gonna
search
it. So they do. And at the time I did not know that you were allowed to like say you don't get to search me. I don't know. Apparently, I don't know. I just didn't know. And the police are very fear-based as well. And so
you got booked on a possessions charge.
I got booked on a possessions charge for less than an eighth of a gram. It was very, very small, but either way, you know, had to post a 3,000 bail, was in jail in San Antonio for 11 hours, returned back to the show, did not tell them. There was a news article posted the very next day that was like, Cirque du Soleil artist arrested in San Antonio for cocaine possession. And so the entire show finds out. And we're transported to the next city in Florida, but we're not allowed to do the shows. And then they decide to keep my friend that had ran in was also arrested with me. He ran. They decided to keep him in the show, but they decided to fire me. I had the drugs on me. It was the most devastating thing of my life. I was like, oh my God, my life is over. This is it. Like, just take me now. It was horrible. Looking back,
Alec, it was like when you lost your 35 cents for milk.
Oh my God. Period. That was like,
pretty much the same thing.
Listen, I don't want to compare suffering here. This isn't the suffering Olympics. But when you show up without your milk money, it's just as traumatic as being arrested on a cocaine possessions charge in Texas. Denali, what I'm hearing from you, what I really love is, because we're running out of time. Because we always get
so much fun. I'm sorry, I babble so much.
This is great. That is the best compliment we've gotten from everybody on the show. Bob the drag queen, you says I usually dread these things, but this is the most fun I've ever had.
You guys are great listeners.
We had people who were like, I don't want to do podcasts. I go, are we over? I can't believe we're Carson Questley.
I love it.
Who only gave us half an hour when we said your time's up. He goes, no, I'm not done. He goes, yeah, you are. Bye, bitch. So she had a hard out because she had to do Access Hollywood. What I'm hearing from you, which I love, is reinvention, resilience, taking your negative experiences and talking yourself through it.
Yeah.
My question is, what I heard from you is when the fandom started responding positively to you, what I heard and what I saw is that you changed your mind about yourself. My question is, have you been able to give that to yourself outside of the fandom?
Going in because deep the 11th hour.
Because the fandom can be you can get very dependent on that too.
Yeah, that's very true.
Oh my God.
Are you living for the applause or can you give it to yourself?
Oh my God. I didn't know this was happening today. that is so good.
It's right in the title, Hot Mess. So it's like,
No, it's good. I'm sorry. I've had a very emotional few days. There's just been a lot of like emotional movement in the universe in general.
Yeah. Understood.
But, you hit it on the nail on the head. I'm my own worst critic. I am my own hardest. I'm very hard on myself. I come from the athletic world and there's so much that I want to improve on now and I want it now and this like that. And sometimes I need that almost massive outward stimulus. That's like, hey girl, no, you're good. We like you or whatever, before I can even begin to think that like I am worthy or that I am of value or whatever. So it's ridiculous, but you're so right. It's something that I've had to teach myself to come from internally. And I could have the love of my life, like my boyfriend who yells it at me every single day, how great I am, but I will not accept it until the numbers are there or unless the bookings are there or unless, you know, this and that. And we live in you guys were saying earlier how hard it is, so many different ways to find that voice right now, but it's so hard for so many reasons. Capitalism. Mm-hmm. It's so hard because of the industry that I'm in, entertainment in general, being queer and internalized homophobia. Mm-hmm. And also this new digital age where we're all ranked numerically, where it's like, you know, your sister has 600,000 followers and your sister has this much money.
It's all external.
Yeah. And we're seeing it. I'm reading every comment. I am seeing every single thing about reception. And it's just like, I'm internalizing all of that. And like, what effect does that have on me mentally, spiritually? So, you know, it's been a really, really, really good practice being able to rewrite my own narratives, like you said, and then make sure that it comes from me internally and not all of these outward things. So
exactly.
And that's just, you know, meditation. That is just being alone with myself sometimes and just being proud of myself. And even things like this, like conversations with like good, well-minded adults that like have been through shit in their life and can just be like, hey, let's talk it out.
Yeah.
You know, I'm that kind of person that calls their mom and is like, mom, I have a problem. And then I don't even let her speak. And I just like talk for 30 minutes and I'm like, okay, I just solved my problem. Thank you. And she's like, okay.
Just having a safe space.
Just a safe space kind of a thing. So it's self-work like that. And here I am babbling again, but
no, not at all.
Yeah.
It's, you know, we had, you know, during the pandemic, everybody was like, I'm going to write a screenplay. I'm going to learn how to make sourdough. I'm going to, you know what I mean? I'm going to learn another language. And we had one of my friends over on the podcast, Jody Sweeten. Remember this interview? And it was, she's so great. She's a recovering meth addict.
Okay.
And she's in recovery. So she's in a lot of therapy. And she said, my intrinsic value does not change. It's immutable. Yeah. It doesn't change whether I'm doing something or not doing something. My value is immutable. My value exists in sitting still.
Yeah.
My value as a person. And wow. And it's like, that's the place we all have to get to. Matt, yep. Are you agree?
Yeah, I totally agree. I was just going to say, because like Oprah says something very similar, which is our value is our birthright. It is inherent. It's not something we hustle for. It's automatically there. And so if we find ourselves spinning in any other way, that's coming from a very irrational belief, not the truth of who we are.
Right. Wow. And the truth is, you could have a million followers or 2 million followers. If you don't believe that yourself, none of that's going to matter.
None of it matters.
Yep. Exactly. None of it matters.
And I know people with 10 million followers who are so unhappy.
Yeah. Right.
You know, it just doesn't matter.
We always ask our guests at the very end of the show what their hot message would be. So given, okay, and you're not the only person who's listening. There's a lot of listeners on the program who come from conservative spaces,
mm-hmm.
who kind of have grown up kind of buying the negative self-talk.
Yeah.
What mm-hmm. would your hot message be to them?
My hot message to them, and I say this at the end of all of my shows, is to believe in divine timing. If you are in a space where you feel invisible or you are very negative and you are, you know, kind of just putting a lot of that negative self-talk on you, understand that life is all about dips. It's all about, you know, ebbs and flows. And that if there is a kind of dark period that you're going through, that it can only be light after that. As cheesy as it sounds, it is a pattern that has followed my life so much, be it the Cirque du Soleil thing, be it my figure skating career, be it the fandom reception on Drag Race, everything. So if you are going through something, understand that there is divine timing with it and it will make sense later.
Wow.
That's what I would say.
That's so great. Where can we, okay, before you get off the show, everybody go to YouTube right now and watch Denali do 100% Pure Love. That's like one of the best, most historically amazing lip syncs that's ever been on. At one point, this is my favorite part of it, Matthew. She goes to the other queens. She raids her. She kills the entire room.
When I tell you I blacked out, I do not remember doing that, but.
Amazing. I was like, okay, there she is. Where can people find you on your socials, Denali?
You can find me on all platforms at Denali Fox. That's DenaliFoxx with two X's. I am a fox. You can just follow me and see where I'm performing. I'm going to be performing all over the UK in September. I'll be in Hawaii in early October, Canada in late October, and then Mexico in November. And then I'm taking a break in December and I'm going to see my family.
Yeah. Self-care.
Thank you so much for doing Self-care. The show.
Yeah. Thank you, Denali.
Thank you guys so much for having me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Love you guys too. Bye.
Matthew, that was like everything I needed to hear.
I know. That was really great.
That was really, really great. What's your hot message, big boy?
My hot message is, I think, something that we kind of touched on a few different times, which is it's really easy for us because of how much, you know, how much bullshit we had to put up with and shame we had to feel about ourselves growing up, that we feel like we have to be extraordinary in order to matter, in order to be okay, in order to be lovable and keep a seat at the table. And that's bullshit, you know, because the truth is that the most beautiful fucking moments in life are the most ordinary moments of life.
Mm.
And so ordinary is beautiful. That's my message.
Like my zit, like the zit on my nose.
It's just... No, that's extraordinary.
It's a total bullseye. What I related to Denali today was the competitiveness of an athlete, because I'm extremely competitive. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing to have high standards for yourself, but being tough on yourself, being hard on yourself, what I've learned, doesn't always make you better.
No, you can't hate yourself into a version you'll love.
You can, exactly. Being hard on yourself, sometimes being gentle with yourself and being nurturing to yourself is kind of what your inner artist is a child. Mm-hmm. That's what makes you bloom. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that with my own kid. I've seen that, you know, I don't want to overpraise him, but when I recognize the things that he's doing well and I highlight him, even as a little kid, I could see him light up. So, so just be listeners, download and subscribe or you'll die. No, I'm kidding. I'm being gentle. Download and subscribe because we love you. Matthew, where can people find you on your socials?
You can find me at MJ Dempsey Psych on Instagram, Twitter, Matthew J. Dempsey Psychotherapy on Facebook. That's it.
Oh yeah. Your Instagram is very fun. I enjoy it. I stalk you on the Instagrams. And
likewise, it's mutual stalking.
You have a very self-effacing smile. You can find me at Alec Mop on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can find us both at The Hot Mess Pod on Instagram. We want to hear from you. Matt and I often have shows where we answer your questions.
Yeah.
So write us. We love hearing from you. Don't forget to download and subscribe. We love you and tune in next week for more Hot Mess Fun. Goodbye.
Bye, everybody.
This has been a Stage 29 podcast production. The podcast is executive produced by Patty Ciano, Laferne Cusack, and Stephanie Kaysen. Our audio editors are Jackson Ruff and Jonathan DeMatti. Callie Kiltz is the social media producer, and a special thanks to the rest of our podcast crew, Rwani Horinagay, William Cusack, Lisa Clark, Katie Brown, and Morgan Kaler.
This podcast has been produced by Stage 29 Productions for entertainment purposes only. The contents of this podcast does not constitute medical or professional advice, do not reflect the opinions of this company, any of its parent companies, affiliates, subsidiaries, promotional sponsors, or advertising agencies. The views expressed by the hosts and guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. For more information, please go to stage29.tv.